African News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Amnesty International accuses Ethiopia of torture. Demonstrators in Burkina Faso protest plans to let the president run for another term. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. The second Texas nurse to contract the Ebola virus is being released from the hospital today. Officials at the Atlanta hospital that treated 29-year-old Amber Vinson say tests show she is Ebola-free. Another U.S. nurse quarantined for exposure to Ebola has been cleared for discharge. Casey Hickox was placed in isolation last Friday after arriving at Newark's International Airport. She tested negative for the virus and had threatened to challenge her quarantine in a lawsuit. Meanwhile, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued new guidelines for returning health workers. The CDC Monday called for health workers at the highest risk of infection to voluntarily quarantine themselves at home. The AFP News Service reports that the Red Cross in Liberia is saying that this week it has collected fewer bodies of Ebola victims in the capital city. The Red Cross describes the number of bodies collected as falling dramatically, perhaps indicating a slowdown in the spread of the disease in the city. Opening Zimbabwe's parliament today, President Robert Mugabe warned that citizens who front for foreign companies will face decisive action. The AFP reports that Mr. Mugabe wants to enforce laws that mandate that foreign firms operating in the country have at least 51% local shareholders. This is VOA News. The human rights group Amnesty International is accusing Ethiopia of torturing members of an ethnic group reputed to be in opposition to the government. The AFP News Service says an Amnesty report says thousands of Oromo people have been subject to arbitrary arrest, prolonged detention without charge, torture, and unlawful killings. Former detainees were interviewed in neighboring countries. A government spokesman denied the accusations in the report. There was violence today in Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou, when tens of thousands of people marched through the streets to protest President Blaise Compaoré's plans to change a term limits law so he can remain in office. Violence broke out when youths began throwing stones as some of the demonstrators made their way toward the National Assembly. On Thursday, the Assembly will begin looking at a proposed constitutional amendment that would increase the maximum number of presidential terms. The Associated Press reports that police fired tear gas at the crowd and that most demonstrators had gone home by afternoon. The AFP says the office of Tanzania's president has issued a statement saying the government will begin the construction of a new seaport next year. The Chinese-funded project at the town of Bagamoyo is intended to boost Tanzania's trading capacity. Botswana's president was sworn in today for a second term. Ian Khama won an election last week. His inauguration ceremony included a 21-gun salute, a flyover by military aircraft, and festive dances. South African police today released drawings of two men wanted for the shooting death of national football hero Senzo Meiwa. Meiwa was killed during a robbery late Sunday. There have been no arrests yet in the case. Police have offered a reward of $23,000 for any information leading to the killer's arrest. Iraqi Kurdish Peshmerga fighters are headed to Kobani, Syria. They're there to help the fight against Islamic State militants. The militants are trying to gain control of the town just south of the Turkish border. Meanwhile, there was fighting today in Kobani. Cameras positioned just across the border in Turkey showed what appeared to be airstrikes by the U.S.-led coalition that has been trying to keep the Islamic State group from taking over the city. Foreign ministers and representatives from 40 nations are meeting today in Berlin to try to figure out how to deal with the huge number of refugees who have fled the war in Syria. Jordanian Foreign Minister Nasser Judeh warned of what he called host country fatigue in trying to keep pace with the needs of so many people. The United Nations has registered more than 3 million Syrian refugees. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The World Health Organization says it is difficult to get across its simple message that people who do not display symptoms of Ebola are not contagious and cannot transmit the disease to others.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from WHO headquarters in Geneva. Details next.
Also, Amnesty International issues a new report claiming that the Ethiopian government is systematically repressing the country's largest ethnic group.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Togo, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the World Health Organization is renewing its appeal to governments not to quarantine healthcare workers returning from Ebola-stricken countries in West Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says it is difficult to get across its simple message that people who do not display symptoms of Ebola are not contagious and cannot transmit the disease to others. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich exhibits a bit of frustration when he repeats the UN Health Agency's recommendation advising against mandatory quarantine. He says health workers who go to West Africa to fight Ebola know how to monitor themselves for symptoms of the disease when they return home.
We desperately need international health workers, and we keep calling for health workers. They are really the key to this response. And these people should not be treated when coming home in a way that they would be stigmatized by the rest of the population.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has issued a statement in support of the health workers, reiterating the best way for any country to protect itself from the deadly Ebola virus is to stop the outbreak at its source in West Africa. The U.S. government has drawn up new health rules calling for returning medics to be monitored for symptoms of Ebola, not placed in quarantine. But the states of New York, New Jersey, and Illinois are standing by their decisions to quarantine health workers for the duration of the 21-day incubation period. Meanwhile, the Australian government says it will bar entry to visitors from the worst affected Ebola countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Jazarevich tells VOA it is too soon to tell whether these restrictive measures will discourage healthcare workers from going to West Africa.
I talk quite often with people who are returning from the field, and it's just amazing how courageous these people are, and especially medical workers. So these people are really real heroes when they go in, spend their time, risk their health. And then this is why it's probably so difficult to accept the fact that they would be quarantined without no reason.
Ebola has infected more than 10,000 people and killed nearly 5,000 since December. Swissmedic, the Swiss regulatory authority for therapeutic products, has just announced that clinical trials of an experimental Ebola vaccine are to begin this week in the Swiss city of Lausanne. This trial, which is supported by WHO, follows ongoing vaccine trials in Mali, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Jazarevich says first results regarding the safety of the Ebola vaccine are expected in December. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Bank says the three West African nations waging a battle against Ebola will need 5,000 more healthcare workers to stop the virus. Ebola has killed an estimated 5,000 people in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Bank President Jim Yong Kim says he is concerned, however, about where that high number of health workers can be found, given the public fear the virus has created around the world. Kim is a former professor of global health and advisor of the Director General of the World Health Organization. He spoke at a meeting with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and African Union Chairwoman Nkosana Dlamini-Zuma in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. And meanwhile, in Switzerland, one of several experimental vaccines being tested in the United States has been approved for testing among more than 100 healthy volunteers at Lausanne University. The tests are being conducted with support from the World Health Organization. The vaccine was developed by GlaxoSmithKline for possible use among health workers in West Africa. It says it may be able to produce 1 million doses per month next year if the drug passes safety and dosage tests. A second vaccine candidate that was developed by the Public Health Agency of Canada is being tested at the U.S. National Institutes of Health.
As the Ebola outbreak rages in three West African countries and raises fears abroad, some are questioning whether the World Health Organization is being too stretched thin. A proposal for a new global agency to deal strictly with infectious diseases is gaining some support. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Dr. Harvey Rubin says that local phenomena can have global consequences, and he points to the Ebola epidemic as a prime example. Rubin is director of the Institute for Strategic Threat Analysis and Response at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. He and ISTAR's associate director, Nicholas Seidel, have written in New Scientist magazine that global infectious disease control, as it now stands, is a disjointed effort riddled with gaps and inconsistencies. Rubin says this can be seen in the response to Ebola.
The world's response has been late and incomplete. This is a tragedy at many, many levels, and obviously people are dying, commerce is impacted, economic development is impacted, but overwhelmingly people are dying, and we could have done a better job as a global community. There are some groups that have been absolutely fantastic, like Doctors Without Borders, and individual aid groups have been putting their own lives at stake, but the global community has dropped the ball.
Rubin says many have been worried about such a scenario for a long time.
A lot of this, maybe not all of it, but a lot of this could have been avoided with a more robust global governance system for infectious disease. This was predictable. We've been talking and writing about this for a long time now, for at least several years. Other people have been writing about this.
TB, malaria, various types of hepatitis, MERS, the flu, measles, polio, and Ebola. These are some of the infectious diseases the WHO has tracked and monitored over the years. And then there are the many non-communicable diseases on the rise, such as diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, and cancer.
Believe me, I'm not critical of the World Health Organization or any of the other groups. They are so overstretched with so many things to worry about. Arguably, more people die of infectious diseases than just about anything else. A lot of these are preventable diseases, and the World Health Organization has a huge mandate.
Dr. Rubin says there's a looming health crisis that's not getting nearly as much attention as Ebola.
If I had to list the number one problem that we see across the borders and certainly in this country, it's antibiotic-resistant bacteria. We have an epidemic already and an impending doom and disaster, and I don't want to overstate this, but we have organisms in this country, in our hospitals, that are resistant to just about every antibiotic that we have. Antibiotic-resistant bacteria is an enormous problem.
He's calling for a global governance structure for infectious disease, a place where any nation can go and raise the alarm about a potential infectious threat. He says it would provide a more focused approach.
What kinds of resources are available for us? Are there experimental drugs that we could start developing? Are there ways to distribute these drugs? Are there ways to do surveillance that's meaningful? Are there ways to harmonize and align various regulatory aspects of getting drugs and vaccines to the places that are needed? That's what we mean by a focused approach on infectious disease. There is no other group like that.
He says the proposed global governance structure for infectious disease should be a public-private standalone agency that receives serious input from the United Nations and others. The New Scientist article lists four interconnected goals. First, coordinate the collection, sharing, and analysis of infectious disease information in real time. Second, encourage the private sector to develop and distribute affordable drugs, vaccines, and diagnostics. Third, establish a network of international centers for fundamental research into microbial threats. And fourth, promote standards for best laboratory, regulatory, and ethical practice. Rubin says the aim is not to have such an agency bogged down in bureaucracy.
We want to have it streamlined. We want to have decision-making with adequate input and transparent, and with the recognition of world leaders that this can only help everybody. There are no borders here. Out of all the diseases that we talk and lecture to the students about, we would always say, oh, Ebola is over there, it's remote, it burns itself out. Now it's in New York, it's in Texas. We have to rethink from the beginning our sort of entrenched ideas.
He says it could begin as a grassroots effort, but adds it may be just the right time for it to happen.
When I've given this talk around the world, I have enormous support by members in my own medical community, a lot of the NGOs, even the engineering community and the policy community. So the academics really understand this, and we're used to collaborating across countries and across domains and across disciplines. The buzzwords around now are innovation and multidisciplinary. Well, if anybody wants innovation and multidisciplinary, this is it.
The University of Pennsylvania medical professor says it must be a self-sustaining agency with innovative ways of funding. Dr. Rubin says it won't work if it has to rely on donors. The staff of the Institute for Strategic Threat Analysis and Response includes doctors, lawyers, business leaders, engineers, and political scientists. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Humanitarian groups in Australia are criticizing the government's policy to impose a blanket ban on visas for citizens of the three West African nations affected by the Ebola virus outbreak. Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok.
The new policy cancels non-permanent or temporary visas for travellers from Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea. Permanent visa holders who have not yet arrived in Australia are being asked to submit to a 21-day quarantine period. Announced by Immigration Minister Scott Morrison, the policy makes Australia the first wealthy nation to close its immigration doors in response to the Ebola outbreak. Despite some suspected cases, medical authorities say there have been no confirmed Ebola cases in Australia. The visa ban has triggered widespread criticism from aid groups and professional health workers, who call the response to the outbreak narrow. Health workers say the country has monitoring and quarantine policies in place that will protect against Ebola spread without stoking public fears over travel bans. The Ebola visa ruling follows Prime Minister Tony Abbott's push to harden the country's immigration policy, making it more difficult for asylum seekers to settle in Australia. Archie Law, executive director of the Australian-based non-government Action Aid organisation, says the policy is a backward step for Australia's international relations, already affected by Canberra's tough stance on asylum seekers.
Look, I think that there's a sense of outrage regarding further visa restrictions at Action Aid. I suppose there's a bit of a shaking of the head. I mean, not only do we refuse to let asylum seekers actually seek asylum in Australia, now we're taking the borders a step further and refusing West Africans to come in here. And, you know, it raises a lot of questions about what sort of country is Australia becoming.
The World Health Organization has recommended against imposing travel or trade bans on the affected nations, arguing that those nations are in need of international help, not isolation, to defeat the outbreak. However, several other countries in Africa and the Caribbean have also toughened entry rules or banned visas for travellers from the three worst affected countries. US President Barack Obama and United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon have appealed to Australia to send personnel to fight the spreading Ebola virus. So far, the country has donated aid, but not medical workers. The government says it resisted sending personnel because of the long 30-hour journey back to Australia for ill patients. Canberra is reported to be in negotiation with European partners to assist if Australian personnel are sent to the region. The current Ebola virus outbreak is the most severe on record, killing nearly 5,000 people in Guinea, Sierra Leone and Liberia. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 20 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top story. The World Health Organization is renewing its appeal to governments not to quarantine healthcare workers returning from Ebola-stricken countries in West Africa. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Amnesty International has issued a new report claiming that the Ethiopian government is systematically repressing the country's largest ethnic group, the Oromo. Marta Vandewolf has more from Addis Ababa.
Amnesty International says Ethiopia's ethnic Oromo are subjected to arbitrary arrest, detentions without access to lawyers, repeated torture, and even targeted killings to crush dissidents. Claire Bestone is the Ethiopia researcher for Amnesty International. She says the East African country is hostile to any kind of dissent, but particularly fears the Oromo for a number of reasons.
Including the numerical size of the Oromo, because they're the largest ethnic group, a strong sense of national identity among the Oromo, and also a kind of history of perceived anti-government sentiment.
Oromia is the largest state within Ethiopia, and about 35% of the population is considered to be ethnically Oromo. Oromo students protested in April and May against the capital city restructuring plan, which they said would dilute Oromo culture through annexing traditional Oromo land surrounding Addis Ababa. The rare protests led to violence. Several dozen people were killed and hundreds arrested. Peaceful Oromo Muslim protests in 2012 and 2013 were also crushed with force and mass arrests. Beston says Oromo students and protesters are not the only ones who are at risk in Ethiopia.
We're talking about hundreds of people, from ordinary people from all walks of life, including teachers and midwives and even government employees, singers, and a range of other professions, who are all arrested just on the suspicion that they don't support the government.
Amnesty International has not been allowed into Ethiopia since 2011. Researchers based the report's finding on several hundred interviews with Oromo refugees outside Ethiopia and telephone and email conversations with Oromo inside the country. Many of the respondents said they have been detained in prisons, police stations, military camps, or unofficial detention centers where they were subjected to repeated torture. Amnesty has concluded at least 5,000 Oromo have been arrested and detained since 2011, many for weeks or months without being charged. The report says they are usually accused of supporting or being members of the outlawed armed group, the Oromo Liberation Front. The OLF has been fighting for self-determination for more than 40 years. The report claims this is just a pretext for silencing dissent. In response to Amnesty, the government, through the state-run Oromia Justice Bureau, says there is no clear evidence of violations as claimed by Amnesty and calls the allegations untrue and far from the reality. Beston says repression throughout the country, and particularly against the Oromo, is likely to increase as the May 2015 elections approach. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
A new survey reveals an increase in Egypt's fertility rate, and that's causing concern among officials. The survey by the Ministry of Health and Population and the U.S. Agency for International Development shows a sudden increase of more than 3% in the number of births. Previous figures had shown the birth rate declining since 1980. Professor Samar Atalla of American University in Cairo said the national education system cannot support the needs of a growing youth population.
For years, poor Ghanaians have been burning old electronics in the open air to extract precious metals and sell them as scrap. But a new recycling center may mean the end of e-waste burning in Ghana. Chris Stein reports from Accra's Agbogbloshie neighborhood.
On the shores of a trash-clogged lagoon in Ghana's capital, Accra, Scrap dealers set gutted electronics ablaze. Fire melts the plastic that stands between the scrap dealers and precious metals like copper. Black smoke belches from the Agbogbloushie neighborhood across the city. The lead levels in the soil around the site are off the charts, up to 100 times above normal. Another study tied the presence of industrial chemicals in women's breast milk in Accra to pollution from Agbogbloushie. For years, the burning of electronic waste in the neighborhood has continued unabated. Most of the men doing the burning are from Ghana's impoverished north. Soumani Abdul Karim has been working here since 1998.
The reason why they don't know how they remove the wire and leave the copper. Yeah, so normally that's why they gather it, go and put it down where they find fire for it, where they go and weigh it.
But the burning may be coming to an end. Environmental group Green Advocacy Ghana recently opened a recycling center at Agbogbloushie. The center is equipped with industrial wire strippers to safely separate copper from plastic. When it is fully operational, Green Ads Executive Director Yao Amoyao Ose says we'll put a stop to the burning.
They know of the harm the burning practices is doing to them. So they were all eager to see some change. They could not stop because they thought it was just a matter of livelihood. They needed to survive. But with this facility, they realized there's no justification to continue burning and harm themselves.
Many of the scrap dealers at Agbogbloushie have grown cynical about the prospects of change coming to the bare, windswept plain. Some of the young men who man the fires have turned against the recycling center, fearing it will harm their livelihood, Karim says. Greater Accra Scrap Dealers Association Chairman Abdul Rahman Abdullahi says many organizations have come to the scrapyard over the years, promising to help. Few have delivered on their promises, but this recycling center may actually work, he says.
We cannot hide the burning because first we wasn't have the machines, but now we have the machines so that we will stop burning, so that things will go fine for us.
On a Monday afternoon, black smoke was still billowing up into the air, across the lagoon and towards Accra's downtown. The recycling center is not fully operational yet and lacks wire strippers for small diameter cables. Amoyao Ose says more equipment and personnel are on their way. Until then, the burning continues. Chris Stein for VOA News, Accra.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Normudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Here's advice from the international medical group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, to help limit the spread of the Ebola virus. First, do not touch or eat the bushmeat of animals from the forest. Avoid contact with blood, urine, feces, vomit, sweat, tears, saliva, mucus, or genital secretions of an Ebola patient. Do not handle the bodies of the patients who have died of Ebola. Inform the nearest health center of any suspected Ebola cases. Seek health care immediately because infected people have a much higher survival rate if they receive early treatment at a health facility compared to staying home. These are recommendations from the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, on how to prevent the spread of Ebola.
The Voice of America, VOA.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The World Health Organization renews its appeal to governments not to quarantine healthcare workers returning from Ebola-stricken countries in West Africa. And Amnesty International issues a new report claiming that the Ethiopian government is systematically repressing the country's largest ethnic group. Coming up, we have music from Togo. And in our feature segment, more than 4,000 U.S. troops are about to battle the Ebola virus in West Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Woolheat, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're tipping off today with basketball.
Kim, let's begin with basketball.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
The National Basketball Association tips off a new season later Tuesday night with three games. The New Orleans Pelicans host the Orlando Magic. The Los Angeles Lakers are at home against the Houston Rockets. And the defending NBA champion San Antonio Spurs play another Texas-based club, the visiting Dallas Mavericks. Before the game against the Mavericks, the Spurs will receive their championship rings from NBA Commissioner Adam Silver. In June, the Spurs defeated the Miami Heat 4-1 in the NBA Finals for their fifth league title. The 38-year-old captain of the Spurs, Tim Duncan, will be participating in his fifth championship ring ceremony. Duncan says he's really going to enjoy the moment, and he won't start mentally preparing for the Mavericks until he has another ring on his finger. San Antonio's head coach, Greg Popovich, has guided the Spurs to all five of their NBA titles. He says it takes a very special type of player, an unselfish player, to be a member of the Spurs.
Before somebody comes in, we do our best to try to figure out who they are at that point and whether we really want to bring them or not. Because we've always thought, you know, people are who they are. You're not going to make a competitor non-competitive or vice versa. You're not going to make a guy a team player if he's not. Selfishness is pretty much not even a topic with the guys that we bring in.
That's Greg Popovich, the head coach of the NBA champion San Antonio Spurs. The Spurs are once again rated one of the top contenders for the trophy this season. Taking a look at another club with good odds of winning the title, LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers should also be among the top teams. LeBron rejoined the Cavaliers in the offseason after winning two NBA championships with the Miami Heat. The Cavaliers also acquired three-time NBA All-Star Kevin Love in a trade with the Minnesota Timberwolves. And at point guard, the Cavs feature Kyrie Irving, who was named Most Valuable Player of the 2014 FIBA Basketball World Cup in Spain. The Cavaliers will play their first game of the season Thursday night against the New York Knicks. Odds makers say the Oklahoma City Thunder, the Chicago Bulls, and the Los Angeles Clippers should also be among the NBA's top clubs. Now, the Thunder will start the season without their best player, Kevin Durant, the NBA's reigning most valuable player. Durant is expected to miss the first 6 to 8 weeks of the schedule with a foot injury.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 1730 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show. While the National Basketball Association gets ready to tip off a new season, another big sports league here in the USA, Major League Baseball, could possibly see its final pitch later Tuesday night. The Kansas City Royals will host the San Francisco Giants in Game 6 of baseball's 110th World Series. The Giants lead the best-of-seven-game World Series 3-2, and they'll clinch the trophy with a victory later tonight. Yes, you might say the Giants have truly been Giants in Major League Baseball in recent years. If the Giants win the World Series, it'll be their third World Series title in the past 5 years. Now, if the Royals win at home tonight, the decisive Game 7 will be played Wednesday night in Kansas City.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
Thanks, James. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma, joins us now with more sports news. And Mark begins with cricket.
Hosts Malaysia beat Uganda by 4 wickets at the Pepsi ICC World Cricket League Division 3 in Kuala Lumpur on Monday. Despite this setback, Uganda still head the log, featuring six nations having won their first 3 matches. In football, hosts Zambia and Ivory Coast play to a 1-1 draw in Lusaka on Saturday, while the visiting Egyptians outclassed Kuwait 5-2. On a sad note, words alone cannot fully express the sense of loss and grief at the shooting to death of South African national team goalkeeper and captain Senzo Meiwa, the Confederation of African Football President Issa Hayatou wrote in a message of condolence to the South Africa Football Association head Danny Jordan. Meiwa was shot dead in Vosloorus Township, some 30 kilometers east of Johannesburg in South Africa on Sunday. As goalkeeper, Meiwa kept a clean sheet in South Africa's matches in their 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations Group A qualifiers. South Africa currently head Group A with 2 rounds of matches to complete the qualifiers. In athletics, Ethiopia's Aberu Kebede clocked 2 hours, 22 minutes and 21 seconds to triumph in the women's race at the BMW Frankfurt Marathon in Germany on Sunday. In the men's contest, Mark Kipto prevailed in 2 hours, 6 minutes and 49 seconds to lead Mike Kigen and Gilbert Yego in a Kenyan 1-2-3 medal podium sweep. Meanwhile, Kenyan Titus Mbishei and Paris Chepchirchir prevailed in the men's and women's contest at the Marseille to Cassis 20-kilometer run in France. Elsewhere, Ethiopians Behailu Mamo and Conjit Tilahun clinched the men's and women's title at the Venice Marathon in Italy, while Kenyan James Rungaru and Ethiopian Belianesh Oljira triumphed in the men's and women's races at the 16-kilometer Bupa Great South Run in Portsmouth, Britain on Sunday.
Thanks, Mark. That's our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma, reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Mark mentioned the BMW Frankfurt Marathon in Germany. The top 8 runners in Frankfurt were from either Kenya or Ethiopia, but the runner who placed 9th was a local favorite from Germany, making his marathon debut, and the energetic Andy Edwards caught up with him. Here's Andy.
We are talking with a man who's made headlines at the BMW Frankfurt Marathon. That is Arne Gavius, who exceeded, perhaps we'll find out, even his expectations by breaking 2 hours 10. He's just sipping what looks like a green tea, but I don't know. We'll ask him about that. And we'll also ask him about his vegetarian diet. Maybe that's been a factor. Arne, it must be a wonderful day for you. What, the first German under 2:10 in 14 years? Fantastic for you.
Yeah, it was
amazing, yeah. So the course was good. The pacemakers were fantastic. The groups, we worked together with the other runners, and it was really, really good, yeah. The feeling was always good. And yeah, after 30K, the last pacemaker dropped out. And then I realized, hey, there's something left in the tank. Now you can push. And then sometimes I had a split. I think from 30 to 35 was around 15:03. So and this is amazing in the debut to run that fast from 30 to 35. Yeah, everybody told me, oh, be careful. Yeah.
It was so good. I mean, not being partisan, but to see a non-African up there running sub-210, that's good for the sport of marathon running. You talked before the race about going back to the track, but well, it's just me talking. Surely now, a sub-210 European marathon runner, you've got to make the marathon your priority, haven't you?
Next year and in the spring, the focus will be on half marathon and 10,000 meter on the track. I think I can improve much better than the 27:55 last year from Stanford. And maybe I will go to Stanford, back to Stanford, to run maybe 27:30. And yeah, I think I can improve on 10,000, also on the half marathon. And we will see, maybe next fall I will be here or in New York or for the marathon.
I know, listening to you give interviews before the race, you were joking about what the world records were, 5 and 10,000 meters for a vegetarian runner. Quite a few of us were scratching their heads at that. I mean, you are a vegetarian, you have been for 18 years. How does that differ for you in terms of a runner who does eat meat? I mean, in terms of your performance today, or do you think it contributes to how well you run?
I think as a vegetarian, you're looking what you are eating. Yeah, I'm always looking, okay, is this healthy, is this organic? Okay, I have to look about my protein, so I need to eat some more cotton cheese, yeah, or some more protein drinks, or more fruits, yeah. I love fruits every morning, yeah, 5 to 7 different choices of fruits. And yeah, and that's helped me to stay healthy, yeah. I think meat is okay for some people, but not too much, yeah.
Well, 12:09. For your second marathon, wherever that might be, maybe it's too soon to start planning and thinking what it could be.
I don't know. Next fall, maybe. It depends how I will finish the summer season on the track. And then we will see. Yeah, after Beijing.
After Beijing, indeed. Well, Arne, I think we're just about ready for you to be doing the mass press conference. Thanks very much and all the best. Arne Galvius.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you, energetic Andy Edwards, for your coverage at the BMW Frankfurt Marathon in Germany. Now let's go to Japan, where organizers of the Fukuoka Marathon have announced their field of elite runners for the race on December 7th. Kenya's Martin Matati will defend his title in Japan. Last year, Martin had a winning time of 2 hours, 7 minutes, and 16 seconds. Meanwhile, another Kenyan, former world record holder Patrick Macau, will also be running the famous Japanese race. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny, and welcome back again. Listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, more than 4,000 U.S. troops are about to battle the Ebola virus in West Africa. And next, the polio virus in Cameroon. But first, some music. Here is Hosti of Togo with Miasimi.
the peace sign and put it up and give each other a hug. Cause I don't know why we hate others. We all one blood, but different color, living in one world, sharing different nature. The same people using different culture as a god children. We need to love each other, stop the blood sharing. Cause little ones are dying, little ones are dying.
Hosti of Togo with Miasime.
While U.S. officials struggle to keep the Ebola virus out, more than 4,000 U.S. troops are about to battle the virus in West Africa, where it all began. U.S. military and U.S. aid personnel in Monrovia, Liberia, are building 17 facilities to treat thousands of victims at the source. They hope without a single infection among the troops. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has details.
About 500 U.S. soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines are partnered up with USAID in Liberia and Senegal to try to stem the Ebola epidemic there. President Barack Obama has now authorized the Pentagon to order some military reserve units to active duty to help forces in West Africa. The head of U.S. military efforts against the Ebola outbreak there is Major General Darrell Williams. He says that throughout his time in West Africa, not one serviceman has shown any symptoms of the virus.
As long as you exercise basic sanitation and cleanliness sort of protocols, using the chlorine wash on your hands and your feet, getting your temperature taken, limiting the exposure, no handshaking, those sorts of protocols, I think the risk is relatively low.
That policy, coming from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has worked for USAID and the U.S. Embassy in Liberia, according to U.S. Ambassador Deborah Malik.
We have been following very carefully the CDC guidance and advice from day one, and to this point, they are keeping us safe.
None of the U.S. servicemen are treating Ebola patients, and only a handful are in contact with specimens from people infected with the virus. But the American undertaking is massive. Soldiers already have built a 25-bed hospital to care for local health care workers who contract the virus. Americans are building up to 17 Ebola treatment units and 65 community care centers. They have two mobile labs in place, with four more on the way. And there are 56 teams providing access to safe burials of Ebola victims across Liberia. But has that work begun to halt the spread of the virus? USAID Representative Ben Hemingway says it's too soon to tell.
When looking at trends, you have to look at it over several epidemiological weeks, and we're constantly working to improve the surveillance on that data and monitoring any trends there.
In addition to the extreme sanitation requirements, officials say the mission has had other challenges. The rainy weather has slowed building in areas. Liberia is just 11 years removed from a devastating civil war that destroyed much of its infrastructure. But one challenge Major General Williams does not expect is combat.
This is a very permissive environment. Liberians like Americans, and we're liking Liberians. The Americans are already here, told us that. So this is not Afghanistan or Iraq.
U.S. officials say the top priority is protecting Americans helping to fight the Ebola epidemic. The general says he feels very comfortable with the rules of engagement in place and approved by the government in Liberia. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Cameroon has reported a fifth case of the wild polio virus this year. Four cases were also reported in neighboring Equatorial Guinea. So the UN World Health Organization is helping Central African countries, including Chad, Gabon, Congo, Brazzaville, and the Central African Republic, to coordinate polio vaccinations for children 5 years and younger. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Combat-ready soldiers of the elite corps, the Rapid Intervention Battalion, have assembled to accompany Cameroon Minister of Tourism, Buba Bello Maigari, and his delegation on a visit to northern regions that share a boundary with Nigeria. The military spokesman, Colonel Didier Bajek, says it has been a routine activity for the military since the violent Nigerian group Boko Haram started attacking Cameroon.
C'est notre métier. Nous ne pouvons le faire au rythme de la volonté de l'opinion ou de...
He says it is their profession to respond proportionately to increasing insecurity, and they cannot work as dictated by public opinion, but by the challenges ahead of them. Minister Maigari says the presence of the military assures them of safety should Boko Haram attack.
We can continue to trust our armed forces, and at the same time to back the armed forces, to back fully, totally our armed forces.
The decision to provide a military escort for officials visiting North Cameroon was taken after Boko Haram adopted targeted assassinations, kidnappings, and hostage taking. In the past 2 years, the group has targeted local chiefs and influential clerics, as well as kidnapping both locals and foreigners. Last month, they attacked the home of Amadou Ali, Cameroon's deputy prime minister, and kidnapped his wife after killing soldiers who guarded his residence. The vice prime minister himself narrowly escaped the attack. Most drivers in the large security convoys accompanying ministers are military men. This has angered some drivers of senior state functionaries who receive additional allowances when they travel with their bosses. Drivers' trade union activist André Engolou says they should be compensated.
Tu as envie de faire ton travail, mais comme la sécurité ne permet pas que tu fasses
ton travail. He says drivers who can no longer go on missions with their bosses because of the Boko Haram threat should be compensated financially, because before the attacks started, they were given outstation allowances when they traveled with their bosses. Captain Haman Jibril, who is in charge of the Military Protection Unit for State Officials, says Cameroon has also fortified security around the residences of its senior state workers and traditional rulers.
Pour l'instant, ce sont ces autorités-là qui sont visées.
He says, for now, they have to assure the safety of senior workers because they are the ones targeted by Boko Haram, and that very soon, with the means available, they will see what they can do to protect all chiefs that are also asking to be protected. Reacting to complaints that Cameroon is spending huge sums of money to protect state officials and leaving the population of some villages on their own, Captain Haman Jibril says because of the increasing need to protect people, they have deployed additional troops to accompany travelers on public transport buses.
Lorsque ces gens-là trouvent qu'il y a,
he says the difficulty they have is that when the assailants notice that there is a soldier in a public transport bus, they shoot indiscriminately and kill innocent travelers. The attackers continue to show increasing sophistication in their ability to mount coordinated attacks, as they have always done in Nigeria. Despite Cameroon's effort to protect the officials and travelers, the Nigerian Islamist group Boko Haram last Wednesday attacked a security convoy. The assailants killed two soldiers and slaughtered nine civilians, exposing their gorged bodies along the road. They also abducted two sons belonging to the chief of Zige Zigage, a locality in the Logon and Shari division, and the elder brother of the chief of Waza, as well as a police officer. Two of the attackers were killed. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Pressing our nation's efforts to confront the outbreak of Ebola fever, both in West Africa and elsewhere, President Barack Obama called his top advisors to the White House for a rare Saturday night meeting to discuss the situation. It was the third such session in 4 days with top administration officials devoted entirely to the crisis. The president also discussed Ebola in his weekly national radio broadcast, urging Americans to learn more about the disease and not to be confused or panicked by rumors or misunderstanding. The U.S. is actively engaged in fighting the Ebola outbreak. It has deployed more than 750 U.S. government personnel to West Africa, making this the largest ever U.S. response to a global health crisis. These efforts are focused on controlling the spread of the disease through a number of activities, such as constructing and supporting Ebola treatment units, airlifting critical medical and relief supplies, supporting burial teams, and increasing the number of labs to double specimen testing capacity. While these actions are critical, health experts acknowledge that breaking the cycle of transmission will also require outreach and active engagement with the affected communities. The U.S. Agency for International Development is working with its global partners to build community care centers, which will provide communities with another level of care and isolation, as well as training on how to protect themselves and their families. USAID is also partnering with affected countries, UNICEF, the Paul G. Allen Family Foundation, and other organizations on the ground to provide thousands of community care kits with the goal of preventing further infections within the community. More than 9,000 of the kits, which contain protective gowns, gloves and masks, soap, and chlorine, have been delivered to Liberia's capital, Monrovia. The United States is also supporting public education and outreach campaigns, reaching some of the most remote areas with life-saving information on how to identify, treat, and prevent Ebola. These messages are being conveyed through radio, text, newspapers, as well as by word of mouth. West Africa is facing the largest, most devastating Ebola outbreak in history. It will take a coordinated global effort to stop this epidemic and help affected countries recover.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.